Our next speaker, of course, as we all realize, is Brother Ray Luke. You know, we always have high expectations whenever Ray gives a talk. He can't just give a talk, because he'd let us down if he did that. And the clue, many times for many of us, is the very subject that he chooses to speak on. And we think this will perk you up. It'll perk you up. The subject that he chooses to speak on, he's entitled it, Mission to Israel. Mission to Israel. Brother Ray.
Thank you, Brother Ray. I bring with me the greetings of your dear brethren of the Jersey City Ecclesia. And as you know, their practice is to do that by virtue of a scripture. And they've asked me to tell you that their love for you is contained in 2 Corinthians 9:8. And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that ye, always having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good work. What a comprehensive, all-embracing greeting. I also want to add to those greetings some personal messages that brethren have asked me to convey. Yesterday I spoke to Brother Carl Hagensick, and he sends his warm Christian love to each and every one of you, and also especially to Sister Elizabeth. Then Sister Florence Hopkins and Alice especially asked to be remembered to the convention. They usually are here, but cannot do so this year. And then a sister in our local ecclesia, Elizabeth Sannix, also asked to be remembered. Our remarks this morning will be a little bit out of the ordinary, because I would like to talk about my personal reaction to this trip that we had to Israel in October of last year. I'm sure that many of you might say, well, we've kind of heard about that, we've read about it in the newsletter, and it may not be as edifying as you would hope it might be, but I will just want to share with you what I felt to be a very edifying experience and how I'm trying to integrate that experience to my understanding of what I believe is the present scene of things and how that fits into prophecy. Now, that is a big order and is very subjective. It's merely Brother Luke's reaction to what he understands to be. And in that spirit, I would like to share it with you. It is entitled, A Mission to Moscow. To Israel. Taking its cue from that very historic mission to Moscow. But here was a mission to Israel. It was undertaken because of an unusual opportunity. As you know, this video film, Israel, Appointment with Destiny, was rather well and is being rather well received here in America, addressed to the Jewish community. It was indeed intended to awaken them to their Zionistic hopes. In response to that, a group in Israel, a young Jewish council, a Zionist group, invited that to be shown and to be distributed in Israel, not in English, but rather in Jewish and in Russian. And they completed that script, and the whole presentation was updated. And with that material, we were invited to come into the land and there to preview it and to present it to the Jewish parliament, the Knesset, and to have a public showing in Jerusalem itself. It was suggested that if a body of brethren could accompany that presentation, it would only add to the general effect. And therefore, in response to an invitation, 76 brethren came from America as a group and for 2 weeks did tour Israel, not with simply a tourist interest, but more particularly as a mission. Now, what is the mandate for that mission? We all felt in Isaiah 41 and 2. Comfort ye, my people, saith your God. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem and cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she hath received of the Lord's hands double for all her sins. This mandate was not originally given to that little group, because back in 1890s, in the latter part of the century, the third volume was written, and that chapter in the third volume, The Restoration of Israel, blueprinted this mandate, how in the chronology of God's appointed time, how the beauties of now, the fact of the restoration of favor to Israel was in hand, was at hand. And how Brother Russell was able to show by means of chronology, dating from the death of Jacob, when the 12 sons of Jacob were now constituted as a nation, projecting forward to the time of favor that they had until they rejected their Messiah, and the master at the temple did lament over Israel, "O Israel, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I would have gathered thee as a hen doth gather her chicks, but ye would not. Behold, your house is left desolate unto thee, unto you." And at that point, the favor that had been to Israel had now ceased. And now a comparable time of this favor from A.D. 33 was to be started. And we saw from Bible chronology that it was 1845 years of favor, and that double the Mishnah, which the prophet said would come, that Mishnah of this favor would project from the date of 33 on to 1878. It was in consequence of that understanding of chronology that Brother Russell was able to point out historically how that had been so precisely pinpointed in history. And that very date, as you all know, the Berlin Congress of Nations, Lord Beaconsfield, Benjamin Disraeli, the only Hebrew prime minister in English history, Benjamin Disraeli was in power when this historic conference was convened. And under the Berlin Congress of Nations provisions, Turkey, the sick man of Europe, the Ottoman Empire, was now being dismembered. And now the Jews, after 1800 years, were given now the power, the authority, the ability, the permission to go back into the homeland, into their promised land. And then, being bankrolled by the Rothschilds, they began to begin their colonies and colonize that area, as they were not privileged to do before. And then it was in 1870 that the first agricultural settlement was established in Palestine, called Mikvah. And that just, as it were, opened the gates, and there's been a trickle of colonization at that point. In consistency with that mandate, Brother Russell then convened these wonderful Zionist discourse in New York City, in the Hippodrome. And how the Jews so responded to it, thousands of them did hear. Oh, he did not preach to them the Messiah, but rather he preached to them their own prophets. He told them of what is in store. He pointed out the fact that now God is turning his favor into their direction, and how they are to listen to their Torah and their prophets and follow their directions, because the Lord has blessings in store for Israel, because now the time of Jubilee is here and now the kingdom of God is at hand. And in response to that, there was a favorable reaction. And so it was that mission that we were embarked upon. And you know, brethren, there's a sense of destiny about something like that. When you feel as though now you are here giving a message which is in God's Word, and you're simply going there to tell them that these are the promises, and we urge you to look to them. We all know how history confirms the fact that God is beginning to turn his favor to them. Oh, we know that God's favor is future, but the beginnings of this process is at hand. Because after the establishment of the foothold in Palestine, then you are all familiar with 1914, the First World War, Weizmann and his development of nitroglycerin, and in consequence of his contribution to the survival of England, how in 1917 he extracted that agreement which we know as the Balfour Declaration, in which England did commit itself towards the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. That was a high water mark. That was the floodgates that opened up now colonization and immigration into the promised land. And then you remember, of course, then 1933 and the rise of Kristallnacht and Hitler in Germany, the fishers and the hunters. Zionism had been fishing, and there was not the response to go back to Israel. Now the hunters were brought into play in response to Jeremiah 16, 15, and 16, and the Holocaust. And in the wake of that, the historical trend of the Jews forcing their way, not by the consent of the world powers, but by virtue of God's direction, forcing their way back into Palestine in 1948, when nobody expected it could happen, when the two superpowers were using that as a pawn, Israel as a pawn, to everybody's amazement, not to the Bible students, however, because they had pinpointed God's appointed time had come. In 1948, the State of Israel was born. And so with that background, we went to Israel. And what did we find? Well, I will just encapsulate it, dear brethren. It was not a travelogue, although we did see some fascinating places. Oh, I tell you, when you go to Israel, and when you see the places where the history of the Bible has just been enacted, it's like reading something in two dimensions and then suddenly seeing it in three dimensions. It is right before you. It is concrete. It is specific. It takes such form and fashion that it just awakens the whole mind into the realities, and all of your understanding just kind of has a bit hitching post on which you can see it with greater realism, and it becomes alive. But our concern was the people. My concern was what's happening. And I will just briefly detail some of the things that we had seen and experienced. One of the things that I found most important was our contact with the people. With our contact, for example, people at every strata of life, people who had in the highest echelons of government and industry, as well as the man on the street, and to be able to get their personal candid reactions, and to see how they are reacting to what is happening around them. Do they have the historical, the biblical perspective? What is the motivation for their being there? Do they have any hopes for the future? And are those hopes Bible-based? We are all seeking those kinds of answers. I might just point out a few of our discussions with individuals, but there were many more that we will not have time to discuss. I was impressed by such people as Colonel Levi, who was the editor and the publisher of the Jerusalem Post. The Jerusalem Post, which I was told is one of the five outstanding periodicals or newspapers in the world, in its area ranking with what the New York Times would be in America. And the editor spoke to us for more than a half hour and was open for questions. I was much impressed. He seemed to me as a man who was a macho man, a man of sensitivity, but a man of strength. He was a colonel in the armed forces, and if I were serving under his command, I would have a sense that this was a man who I could follow, because he had the dynamics and the drive of what I would expect in a leader. In his discussions with us, with great sensitivity and obvious awareness, he was able to talk about four areas which were of concern to him. First, defense and security, outlining the fact that there's a whole new balance of power now in the Mideast, with Russia now in its decline. No longer were the superpowers using that area as a chess game of power, but rather now everyone was courting favor with America, the remaining superpower. And now the Arabs find themselves pretty bereft of support, and they are currying favor with the West, or trying to outbid Israel. And that is the only reason, Colonel Levy said, that they are at the peace table. And he pointed out some of the problems of bargaining with such, difficult mentality of the Mideast, how they are very unscrupulous in many matters and unfathomable, how time means nothing to them, and how honor and face and bargaining seems to be all of a game, and they can stay and they can wait indefinitely, and it's difficult to bargain and to deal with them. But they are coming together because they feel a necessity, because they feel their interests are now perhaps to talk over a peace table. And for the first time in 44 years, they were willing to talk to Israel. He said, however, we're not being fooled. We have to keep our guard up, because if we make one mistake, they will come in and they will destroy us. Then in the second area, he spoke of the absorption of the immigrants. And he talked how in 2.5 years, the immigration from Russia increased their population by 420,000, an 11% increase, and gave us a little bit of the problem of what it means to absorb for jobs, for housing, for schools, for utilities. How do you absorb such a massive group? It's just as though America would, within 2.5 years, take the entire population of France and bring it into America and try to absorb it. That is the same proportion as to what Israel has had to do in the last 2.5 years in view of its migration. The stress and the problems that this causes at every level of society. The third point he pointed out was their economics and how they're trying to build up their industry and how they're trying to recruit money from investment from abroad. And he made one fact which I thought was tremendous. He said, 1 out of every 10 CAT scan that is used throughout the entire world is made in Israel. That they have high-tech industry, and that they are really at a point where they are exporting software and computerware to Japan itself, and how they are trying to absorb more and more of manufacturing. Then the last point that he made was the relations with the United States, and how there is a great propaganda war going on. And he made one point which was very, very significant. He said, there is even revisionism of history, but also even in translations of the scriptures. He said, you know, you've got to be careful of some of these translations, because there is a rewriting of the Bible goes on, and there are little nuances in some of these writings, and as you change some of these little nuances, you get the feeling of maybe Zionism is not being taught in the scriptures. But he says, anyone who reads the Bible must believe in Zionism because it's so clearly there. But some of the newer translations may obscure somewhat that emphasis. And so he says that Christian anti-Semitism so often is based on Christian dogma. And he said, in news reporting, we must be more factual. And he, being the editor of the Jerusalem Post, knows whereof he speaks. And he says that news reporting must show more legitimate public opinion. So we went from Colonel Levi, and we had opportunity to question him on several levels, and he was very forthright in his answers, and he was clear in his understanding that truly they are there to state that there are promises given by God, and this land is theirs, and they have an assurance of that fact. Then we went on to talk to such people as Professor Brandover, a scientist, an immigrant from Russia. A brilliant man. The Russians wouldn't let him go because he was too valuable. But when he came to Israel, he has dedicated himself to one purpose, and that is to help integrate the Russian immigrants by giving them jobs in industry and creating those jobs for them. He took us into one of his plants, and there we saw, I guess, 40 or 50 people were employed, and they were doing high-tech industry, and they had developed various hydrometers and meters for monitoring industrial processes, a kind of calculating various monitoring equipment. And he was telling us how they are developing these products so that they can put their immigrants to work, because that seems to be the greatest need at the present time. He was very forthright, and one can see that he had the spirit of dedication to the land. In Jerusalem, there are engineers and there are atomic physicists sweeping the streets. And there are the most highly trained professionals doing the most menial tasks because there's nothing else for them to do. And they have a surplus of brain power, and how to put that to use is one of his major objectives. The dedication he showed was very assuring. And then we talked to a lot of rabbis. A lot of rabbis, and they were interesting people. For me, especially as a former social worker, to talk to Rabbi Grossman, it was really a thrill, because he is probably what you would call the Father Flanagan of Israel. He was a sixth-generation Jerusalem rabbi. And he noticed that in 1953, in Megiddo, or right near Megiddo, there was a North African community. And that was one of the real headaches for the Israeli government, because that seemed to be a drug and crime center. They were having a lot of problems there with young people. And so, as a committed rabbi to the law, he felt the concern, and he went over to Migdal HaEmek. It means the Tower of Darkness. And he went there, and he became what is known as the disco rabbi. He would frequent the various places where there were these young problem people, these youngsters who were really unconnected and had very little family ties. And he would go there to try to befriend them and to get to know them and let them, you know, talk about their problems. But he saw that there had to be much more done than that. And so in 1972, he started what he called the OHR, O-H-R. And he called his little residence for 18 boys who were, instead of going to jail, they were sent, they given to him to try to rehabilitate. And he established this little community called Migdal Or, which now means the Tower of Light. And from that little start, he now has at Migdal Or a facility for 3,000 young people who are in conflict with the law, and he is rehabilitating them. And he showed us throughout, and he had little tots from the nursery grade level right up to young adults, and how he has almost a total community, and he is utilizing all of the activities, and has a staff of over 400 or 500 people. He is a true Father Flanagan of Israel. But to hear the man talk about his dedication, what is his approach? Why am I talking about this? Because he has one solution. He says the only answer is the Torah, the law, the promises of God. We have got to get our people back to what God has given us. And we've got to help them to see that this is their heritage, their roots, and this is the only thing that can bring them together. And as we bring them back to this faith, they will find themselves and their destiny, and they have their destiny here at Israel. And he loved the Torah. He says, this is what we must emphasize, the promises of God. And with that, I sense that he is a man of a personal warmth and a love for people that I can see is very pervasive. Then we could go on to a couple of mayors that we talked. Now, let me just in passing talk the mayor of Mitula. And Mitula is a little finger sticking in the most extreme northern part of Israel, right into the underside of Lebanon. And right there, at the very tip, is this little town of the little town in which we talked to Mayor Yossi Goldberg, this town of Mitula. Mitula means little Switzerland, a little resort area. But it is really a hotbed. And anyone living there is really a pioneer, because it is right in the middle of the firing lines, is right next to that debarkation zone, just south of the Litani River, with the United Nations peacekeeping form in between, holding the terrorists at bay so that they would not be shooting into the settlement. But the night before we got there, there had been several volleys of rockets coming in. So they are constantly under siege. But there we are told by Rabbi Goldberg, and what, again, another warm man. His grandfather is one of the original founders, from having fled to Israel in the 1890s, having fled from a Russian pogrom. And there now he, as mayor, told about what he called the good gate. the good gate. How during the time when the PLO was fighting with the Christian Lebanese, and they were butchering and massacring, they opened this gate to allow some of the Christian Lebanese in for refuge, gave them hospital help, gave them jobs and food, and tried to help resettle them and to bring them, perhaps let them go back when things settled down. And how they opened up their lands. And as we went up to the outside of the city, we looked over the barbed wire, and there we saw the Lebanese soldiers and the tanks and the guard houses. And you can just see it's still an armed camp. And infiltrators come through all the time, and how the Israeli police and the soldiers are right there. You realize that you are at an armed camp, that all around them is all the perimeter of Israel seems to be an armed camp. We ourselves experienced that in our bus tour going through the northern parts on the West Bank. We had to have an armed escort, but then as we were going through, stones came and stoned the buses, broke big, beautiful windshield and dented the sides of the bus. At every hand, we had the sense of hostility, a sense that there is still this feeling and this tension there. And yet, with it all, there were these people, strong, having a trust and a hope, and were also having a sense of desperation with it as well. We could go on to talk about the Soviet refuseniks and how they experienced anti-Semitism in Russia and how when they came to Israel, what difference it made. We could talk about our discussion going to the home of a recent emigrant making Aliyah from Memphis, Tennessee, a family, and talking to the woman and how for the last 5 years she had to adjust with her two children and her husband, and how when the Desert Storm War came, their parents in Memphis were urging, pleading with her to send those two children back to America because it would be too dangerous for her, and the problem, the conflict she went through in deciding, shall we remain, shall we not, my husband's in the army and we may have a war, the rockets were being threatened, and they were beginning to send them over. She made that decision to stay. And she said, when I made that decision, she said, I know that this is my land, and these are my roots, and we are going to stay, and then God has given this to us. That same mental fire. But then we went on to the opportunity to witness. Oh, we had the opportunity to talk to individuals. And we had the opportunity to go into a shopping mall, a modern shopping mall, and it was interesting to see the different people that were there. The Ben Yehuda Mall. And there we saw and had the golden chance to pass out some of these videotapes. And how they mobbed us. And how they were grabbing for them. And how we had a chance to stop and tell them, look at your prophets are telling you this, now you better get back to your scriptures. And you know, they were amazed that here were Christians, and they were suspicious too. What is in it for you? What are you trying to do? Are you trying to proselytize? And we came there clearly wearing on our, well, clearly telling them that we are there as Christians who understand and believe in Zionism, who are not trying to proselytize, and who are simply telling them that they have a glorious future in God's promises, and they are to believe them and act upon them because God's dealings will soon be apparent to them. Well, I got so much to say. Let me just tell you then, I must cut short these interviews. Let me just tell you then, the last witnessing effort. And this was at the Hotel La Romi, and I'm sure you all read it in the newsletter. We were so amazed when we walked in and saw that room in the Hotel La Romi, where there was wall-to-wall people and people standing 5 or 6 deep all around the sides of the room. The room was supposed to hold 800, but there were 1,200 people shoehorned into that area. And there we were, and we saw that presentation. Israel appointment with destiny was shown, and the applause that followed, and the interest that was shown, it was just something that woman would never believe, because one could see that they were getting a message which Brother Russell was conveying to the Jews in the Hippodrome some 90 years or 85 years earlier. Just to think that we in this mission to Israel had the opportunity to go there in the same spirit to tell them that in comfort that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she received of the Lord's hand a double for all her sins. And now we're at the threshold of God's favor returning to them. What a thrill, dear brethren, to say this to them and to have people believe it and rejoice in it and applaud for it. Well, we could say so much more, but let me go on to what I think is probably most meaningful for me. It's all right to go there as an individual, as a tourist. But what do you learn from it? How does it change my understanding and my perception of Scripture? How does this contribute to my growth and my zeal for the Lord? And what does it do for me as well? Well, I would just suggest, dear friend, that I have had a very interesting opportunity to dialogue when I was there. But I learned three things from this. One is that blindness is very much still in Israel. I was talking to the rabbis, and one of the rabbis was Menachem Khomeini, brother to the Maya Khomeini, who was slain, the Jewish Defense League leader, who was slain by one of the very terrorists that is now imprisoned, who shot him, and his group was involved now with the bombing that just happened in New York City last week. But this Rabbi Khomeini talked about his hopes, and he certainly had them. But in his discussions, when we asked him about his understanding of the resurrection, his understanding of the prophets, we could see that he was drawing on so much of the Talmud and of the interpretations of their leaders. And we realized that, which what we all knew, that the Talmud was really that great block. And until they can get around the Talmud, they are in their blindness. Because, you know, the Talmud is based upon the interpretations. Israel has the written law, but then they have what they call is the verbal law. And the verbal law and the written law is a part of what they call the Gemud, I believe is the word. And that is interpretations by the many rabbis. And each one of those scriptures may have as many as a half a dozen different interpretations. And so that becomes their commentaries. And until they can get to the scriptures and forget their rabbis and the teachings of their mystics, they are far from understanding. And then secondly, trust in man. They must get around that. I had a fascinating experience at one of the showings. We showed the film about a half a dozen times. And I had an opportunity to talk to one man before the showing and after the showing. After the showing, I asked him what he thought of it. He said he thought it was great. And he said, but you know, and I said, how did it all come about? What do you believe? What is your faith in how it happened? He said, it happened because now we are willing as Jews to stand up. We are now fighting for ourselves. Now we are taking matters into our own hands. We are not allowing ourselves to be persecuted as we were so much in the past. He said, now because we're standing in our strength, we're able to accomplish so much. I looked at him and said, is that so? He says, yes. I said, well, now tell me, how do you account for the fact that in your illustrious history of the last 1,800 years, you had heroes, you had fighters, you had great people, leaders of the highest caliber, men of strength. They all tried, and they failed. Now, why is it all of a sudden you suddenly are trying and you're succeeding? Are you any better than the previous generations? He looked at me, and he said, what do you mean? I said, well, I mean that the reason why we're here is to tell you that because you see these wonderful events going on around you, it's not in your strength, but it's in God's strength. God's favor is beginning to turn towards Israel. And now it's because he's allowing you and giving you the ability to do this that is all happening. And he looked at me, he smiled, put his arm around me and said, you ought to come back more often. That, you see, is something that they got yet to learn, that it's not in their own strength. And the third thing I've noticed clearly, that they are weary of war, they are weary of defense, they are weary of preparations. You think we have war fatigue. We talk about a peace dividend, and we talk about, you know, the burden of defense. You can't imagine how that takes over 50% of their budget, and how their lives are mortgaged to the army, as it were, until they're age 57, I believe, and how they are war-weary. And so I can see how the climate has been. For now, let's discuss, let's negotiate, let's try to work out something by compromise. And this has been the latest of their political struggle. The struggle between the two major parties, the Labour Party, which is giving land for peace, which is now in negotiations, and the Likud Party, no land for peace. And this is a very intense political dispute going on. But the present government, which was voted in last year under the leadership of Itzhak Rabin, is now undertaking negotiations, much to the displeasure and opposition of the Likud Party, which is being headed by Nathan Yahu, who spoke to us, by the way, and also the deputy director of the Knesset, who feel that there should be no compromise on this score. Well, now, all right, Brother Ray, what do you do with that? I must come back then to the bottom line. What is the future of Israel? Do you have any suggestions as to what the chance might be? Well, I would suggest, dear friends, that I'm looking for the fulfillment of five yet unfinished prophecies. I'm looking for the fulfillment of the unwalled cities prophecy, Ezekiel 38:11. I'm looking for the prophecy of when they shall say peace and safety, Ezekiel 34:28, 38:8, 12, and 14, Jeremiah 32:37, and 23:6. I'm looking for more territorial expansion, the territory that was given to, or was promised to Father Abram, Genesis 12:20, and elsewhere. And also, of course, we're all looking for the invasion of Gog and Magog, Ezekiel 38:39. We've all seen 37 chapter of Ezekiel being fulfilled, how the valley of dry bones is coming together, the bones are forming, but then there is the rattling, and then there is the sinews, the muscle, and then there is added to that the skin, and then after the skin there is the breath, and then Israel stands up. We're looking for all this being fulfilled, and it is being fulfilled by degrees. It is just little beginnings, but by little and little we see it accomplished. And as I'm looking for these various prophecies to be fulfilled, has my experience perhaps given me a little different perspective than what I had before? Yes, I think it has. I think, for example, that in the past we've been thinking that some of these prophecies will be brought about by armed conflict, as it has been in the 7 or 8 wars that Israel had been in. I detect that the balance of power and the mood of the people may perhaps suggest that this may not be the direction in the future. I think that Israel's excursion to Lebanon a few years ago was a costly one. It taught them a big lesson, that you cannot occupy hostile territory. We have learned today that the Intifada in the Gaza Strip and in the northern Western Bank, how kids with stones can immobilize the most modern army, how they can throw the Molotov cocktails and the stones and hold at bay soldiers who are well equipped, because behind those children and behind those women are television cameras that are flashing throughout the world, and the Arabs are the greatest propagandists, and the media is in cooperation with them, and every time a stone or a pellet that can be just as deadly as any bullet is hurled, that is considered an act of delinquency or an act of childhood aggression. But when anyone tries to defend against it, it becomes oppression, it becomes exploitation, it becomes barbarianism. And so Israel realizes that they have a difficult time trying to occupy and to hold lands. And so I believe that they, and the mood of the people is such where they are trying to come to some sort of an accommodation around the peace table. And it may well be, dear friends, that the objectives that Israel hopes to achieve, and which we expect would be achieved by the time Gog and Magog would be ready, could be done by other than hostile means. I would suggest, dear friends, that the PLO is not really the only problem that Israel has to face. If tomorrow the PLO issue were resolved, there would be a half a dozen other issues that might be equally as divisive between the Arabs and the Jews. For example, water is a critical element. And you may be sure that there will be hostility over that if all the other arrangements are compromised. Not only water, but the general economic depravity of the Arab states around it. Jordan is a economic waste basket case. Lebanon is destroyed. Egypt is just tottering on collapse. Syria is almost in bankruptcy. And when you think of the entire region, it is really a seriously underprivileged area. There is sentiment in the United Nations that this problem is a regional one and that the problem should be settled on a regional basis, not only just politically, but economically as well and socially. And so I would believe, or I suspect, that they may come to a point where they might begin to try to think in terms of overlapping some of these jurisdictions. And that Turkey, Egypt, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon might be combined together as a kind of an economic union, not because they want to, but because they have to. Just like in Europe today, the European community, economic community, there are these visionaries who believe that the same can be done with the Middle East under United Nations auspices, that if they can begin to resolve some of their economic problems, the other problems would not be as acute. And there are pressures underway to that kind of a solution. And I can see that if that is happening, or if it moves in that direction, I can see, dear friends, how all of these expected prophecies could be fulfilled in that manner rather than in the manner heretofore. For example, if there were an economic agreement, or compromise, or at least even just a pact, a trade agreement, where that region would be considered as one unit, I can see where Israel would dominate that entire area because of their brain power, because of their resources, because of their ability and their ingenuity and their willingness to work and to tackle tough problems. And by that means, they could be the leading figure in that economic coalition. And they would be, as it were, not militarily occupying, but economically penetrating, and having their influence from the Euphrates right down to the river of the Nile. And that entire area, which we would expect would be under Israeli control, could very well be included in this kind of arrangement and in this compromise. And peace and safety, unwalled cities. Yes, Israel trusting under the protection of the United Nations and America itself would feel a contentment and a security which would be entirely false. Not trusting in Jehovah, not trusting in God, in the one who had given them, made it all possible, but rather trusting in themselves. And in that event, they would just be building up and being like a little garden spot flourishing. And then, of course, the rest of the world, having its problems, and look north of Israel and Russia and all the dangers that are there even today. We think that communism is dead and we think that they've changed over to capitalism. Well, I think Mr. Clinton in Washington today is very much worried about the possible resurgence of communists to try to turn back the advances that have been made in the last 2 years. But at any rate, there is the fact that the rest of the world, having its own problems, will not be able to think too much of Israel, except perhaps as plunder. And the land of the north, Gog and Magog, Russia and those hordes that will be aligned therewith, could see that in this developing, burgeoning, growing, flourishing area that would find some plunder, and that would be the prize which they would be seeking. And Israel would lose its lovers because America would be so much involved with our own needs You remember that last year we were giving and have been giving $2 billion a year for Israeli economic and military support. How Bob Dole, the minority member, minority leader of the Senate, stated that Israel is getting too much money, that we have to cut down on foreign aid, and that now Israel is not nearly as important to American interests in the Middle East as it was when Russia was a threat. How they're losing interest in Israel, and how they are willing to sacrifice Israel's interests for their own gain. And so, given this scenario, and I'm saying, dear friends, this is just a hypothetical conjecture on my part.